A humanitarian crisis developing in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
WHO is especially worried for the health and safety of women and girls who are at the higher risk of violence, including rape.
A freeze on American foreign aid spending is already being felt in Ukraine.
This money from USAID was used to strengthen the public sector, implement reforms, restore the energy sector, build school bomb shelters.
And the leaders of the United States and Colombia hash it out on social media, but managed to avoid a trade war.
The way that it came up was in the dead of night through the Twitterverse, and without apparently much consultation with diplomats or foreign ministries or what have you, and it deteriorated quickly into a battle of tweets.
Today is Wednesday, January 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. As we've been reporting all week, the fighting in eastern DRC is intensifying. The Congolese army is battling rebels backed by neighboring Rwanda in and around the city of Goma. The UN says 5.5 million people in the region have been displaced, and they warn of a humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
United Nations officials describe scenes of utter chaos amid escalating violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, with hundreds of thousands of people fleeing multiple active conflict zones. The spokesperson for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says colleagues in Goma report heavy small arms and mortar fire across the city, with many bodies in the streets.
We have reports of rapes committed by fighters, looting of property, including of a humanitarian warehouse, and humanitarian and health facilities being hit. Hospitals in Goma are reportedly overwhelmed, struggling to manage the influx of wounded people.
Since the flare-up of fighting in recent weeks, Laerke says hundreds of thousands of people have fled the violence, including 700,000 displaced people living in dire conditions on the outskirts of Goma. He adds non-essential UN staff have been relocated to reduce risks, but critical personnel remain in Goma. The World Food Programme spokesperson in the DRC, Shelley Takral, says WFP is retaining only critical staff in this volatile area. Speaking from the capital, Kinshasa, she told journalists in Geneva that protection concerns are growing. She says gender-based violence is rampant and people have limited access to food and clean drinking water.
We've seen families fleeing the fighting, and they're facing unimaginable challenges. Every step of their journey is fraught with danger. Roads are blocked, ports are closed, and those crossing Lake Kivu risk their lives in makeshift boats.
Dr. Adelheid Marsheng is the World Health Organization's emergency coordinator for the DRC. She says hundreds of people have been admitted into hospitals, most with gunshot wounds, with many at risk of secondary infections.
WHO is especially worried for the health and safety of women and girls who are at the higher risk of violence, including rape. Pregnant women are at risk with very high maternal death rates, even before this recent escalation of violence.
She warns conditions in this battle-scarred region are rife for the spread of infectious diseases such as cholera and measles. She says both the physical and mental toll of this war is likely to be enormous. As the risks grow, she notes, it will become much harder for people to get the health care they need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Fighting in this part of Africa has been going on for decades. For some help in figuring out who's fighting and why, I'm joined by Omari Kaseko, a TV producer with VOA's Africa Division, and he's director of the award-winning documentary, A Silent War.
What we're seeing right now is a fight between M23 and the Congolese forces. In recent weeks, the fight has intensified, mainly because the M23 group has been gaining territories. They've been capturing some cities. And now what we are seeing is the confirmation we have is finally they are in Goma.
So the M23, that's the rebel group, and they're backed by Rwanda. Are the two countries fighting?
There've been accusation that Rwanda is backing M23. According to the UN, of course, they have more than 8,000 fighters. the DRC, the United Nations, and other countries have been saying that, of course, M23 is getting their backup from Rwanda. But Rwanda has been denying these allegations. And of course, they've said so many times that they are not connected to M23. In 2022, however, UN experts said in a report that they had solid evidence that Rwandan soldiers have been working with M23.
So you said that M23 is protecting the Tutsi minority, but there's over 100 armed groups, you also said. So what's the fight about? Is it along ethnic lines? Are they competing for that mineral-rich land? What's this all about?
They're saying the idea is to safeguard the interests of the Congolese Tutsi and other minorities, including protecting them against Hutu rebel groups who escaped to the DRC after taking part in the 1994 genocide that targeted Tutsis.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to ask, when you have fighting between Hutus and Tutsis, it brings to mind the Rwandan genocide. Is this a holdover from that conflict, or are its roots in the same conflict that that was?
You have to understand also, in DRC, there's a group called FDRR, Democratic Forces of the Liberation of Rwanda. The Rwandan government has been saying that Congolese government is supporting FDRR. And it's the same for the Congolese government saying that M23 has been backed by Rwandan government. So there's all these issues that is happening. But they've been saying that the idea is to protect the minorities in Eastern DRC.
So this fighting is going on the eastern side of the DRC. Goma is about 2,600 kilometers away from Kinshasa, the capital, where the army, Congolese army, would be getting its orders from. Are the people in the eastern DRC, the citizens of Goma, do they want to be part of the DRC? Or is this a breakaway province like we've heard of in other parts?
I think when you talk to people, most people in Goma, you know, these are Congolese people living there. And of course, because of the border of that area, you find people from different tribes, you know, Tutsis living there, you know, and of course, Hutus, Congolese. And so there are so many people from different ethnic groups living in those areas in Eastern DRC. What people are saying, actually, they want peace. I don't think a lot of people have an idea of who they want to break up. They want Goma to be independent or Eastern DRC to be independent. A lot of people just want peace. Mainly what they would like to see is at least negotiation between Kinshasa, the government in Kinshasa, and M23. So I wouldn't say they want to break away. I think majority of people, they're not looking at it that way. At least a lot of people that we spoke to, they just want peace. They want to live in their land. They acknowledge that they live in DRC, and that's part of DRC.
Omari Kaseko is a TV producer for the Africa Division here at VOA, and he's the director of the award-winning documentary A Silent War. Omari, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for your reporting.
My pleasure. Thank you.
U.S. President Donald Trump has frozen most foreign aid while his administration reevaluates government spending. War-torn Ukraine is heavily dependent on U.S. humanitarian aid, and its pause will likely have terrible consequences for many NGOs and the people they're trying to help. VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv spoke with the founder of one such organization that will lose its USAID funding.
After President Donald Trump froze all foreign aid programs for at least 90 days for further review, numerous Ukrainian NGOs are facing a funding nightmare. Many of them rely on American government money and could not exist or carry out their missions without it. The decision from Washington came as a shock for most of them, with not enough time to prepare or reorganize their operation. In Ukraine, programs funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, have been hit the hardest. Following the Russian full-scale invasion, Ukraine has lost billions of dollars in foreign investments in its economy. This money from USAID was used to strengthen the public sector, implement reforms, restore the energy sector, build school bomb shelters, and fund programs for veterans, IDPs, and people with disabilities. Some Ukrainian NGOs relying on USAID funding came out with official statements saying this decision means they can no longer function. Many, like Veteran Hub, announced the closure of their offices and cut off personnel. However, most of them do not comment on the current situation publicly, while they are waiting for the 90-day period to end and further decisions to be announced. I talked to Bohdan Logvinenko, founder of the independent Ukrainian multimedia organization Ukrainer. This project creates multimedia materials and books about Ukraine in different languages. Most of its funding came from the USAID program.
So we cut in the team, we cut in the products we can make by this year. And we are trying to find some European programs, and we have to do it really fast.
Bohdan says the situation for them is now critical. They are not able to continue to produce as many materials as they used to and do not have a budget to pay for the work that has already been done.
We are trying to involve more and more volunteers to end some projects which are already done. We tried to prepare. We were applying to some European programs.
Bohdan worries that Ukraine will face stricter conditions for receiving U.S. aid in the future. Of course, this issue has the attention of Ukraine's government leaders as well as the NGOs.
Багато проєктів. Визначимо, які з них критичні.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Tuesday that the Ukrainian government will determine the most critical projects that were stopped due to the freeze of U.S. support and provide state funding for them. For the continuation of the rest of the programs, Ukraine will conduct additional negotiations with European and U.S. officials. According to the latest official information from both U.S. and Ukrainian officials, the funding that was frozen applies mainly to humanitarian, social, and public sector projects. U.S. military aid remains active as of now. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. On Tuesday, Pakistan's parliament approved amendments to the country's Digital Crimes Act that are aimed at stemming what the government says is an influx of fake news. Opposition lawmakers and media rights groups warned that the changes suppress freedom of expression by exposing journalists and social media users to increased restrictions and legal action. The new amendments call for a 3-year prison term and a fine of more than $7,000 for spreading fake and false information. The amendments also broaden the definition of content that authorities can block, and it sets up new agencies to regulate online content. A little more than a week after Beijing and Manila reached an agreement aimed at easing tensions in the South China Sea, the Philippines has accused Chinese Coast Guard vessels of fresh incursions, harassment, and aggressive maneuvers. Analysts say the pressure campaign is part of Beijing's attempt to test the United States' commitment to supporting the Philippines. In response to Manila's accusations, Beijing said Chinese Coast Guard vessels thwarted two Philippine vessels attempting to land on one of the Spratly Islands. A full-scale replica of the secret apartment annex where Anne Frank wrote her famous diary opened in New York City on Monday, as the world marked International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The exhibit at the Center for Jewish History in Manhattan represents the first time the annex has been completely recreated outside of Amsterdam, where the space is a central part of the Anne Frank House Museum. The New York exhibit runs through April 30th. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. It was a wild ride this past weekend as Colombia's president tussled on social media with U.S. President Donald Trump, pulling back from the cusp of a trade war after the White House insisted the South American nation accept deportees as part of Trump's hardline immigration push. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell has the story from Washington.
President Donald Trump's hardline position on immigration is ruffling feathers in the U.S. and further afield as he makes a show of deporting foreign nationals back home. Guatemala accepted a group recently, but Colombian President Gustavo Petro over the weekend rejected two plane loads of deportees, landing him in a social media brawl with the U.S. president that escalated into insults, tariff threats from both sides, and then hours later, a capitulation, with Bogota accepting the returnees and sending the presidential plane to collect them. Trump was very clear on this issue during his campaign, his administration says. Caroline Levitt is White House press secretary.
President Trump is sending a very strong message to people around this world. If you are thinking about breaking the laws of the United States of America, you will be returned home, you will be arrested, you will be prosecuted. Do not come.
Colombia's foreign minister said a delegation would arrive in Washington in coming days to hash out this issue and others. Luis Gilberto Murillo is Colombia's foreign minister.
Seguiremos recibiendo a los
We will continue to receive Colombians, Colombian women, and Colombian men who return as deportees, guaranteeing them dignified condition as citizens with rights.
When asked who won this weekend's spat, analyst Eddie Acevedo said,
I believe it is very clear that President Trump and the United States won this weekend.
It all happened very quickly and without the steady hand of diplomacy, analysts say. Eric Farnsworth is vice president and Washington office head of the America Society and Council of the Americas.
The way that it came up was in the dead of night through the Twitterverse and without apparently much consultation with diplomats or foreign ministries or what have you. And it deteriorated quickly into a battle of tweets and really created anxieties and circumstances that didn't need to occur.
On the table for diplomats, experts say, is Colombia's status as a major non-NATO ally, an exporter of coffee, cut flowers, and more. And on the illegal side of the ledger, analysts note that Colombia's coca production has shot up recently, complicating the two nations' drug interdiction efforts. Acevedo again.
Very soon, President Trump will have to make a determination regarding security and drug cooperation with Colombia. And to me, that's going to be the next red flag in the relationship.
Meanwhile, in Bogota, tensions remain. On Monday, dozens of Colombians who showed up at the U.S. Embassy were told their visa appointments were canceled. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Couple stories now about Syria and how it's getting on with its neighbors after the fall of the Assad government. Jordan faces challenges in dealing with Syria's transitional Islamist regime. A strategy of containment through engagement, analysts say, is being pursued to secure its long-shared border, where Syrian smuggling of drugs and weapons has occurred and where risks posed by the Muslim Brotherhood threatens Jordan's politics and stability. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman al-Safadi, told the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, Switzerland last week that Jordan has engaged very deeply from day one with Syria's new Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, leaders to tackle challenges both countries face. Jordan and other countries want to see inclusive governance in which all of Syria's religious and ethnic minorities are represented.
Terrorism is one common threat. We see Daesh rearming, regrouping. They've acquired a lot of weapons from the stockpiles of the Syrian army. Drug trafficking is still happening to Jordan. We have the same interest here in ending that threat because we have an interest in Syria succeeding. What happens in Syria will have a direct impact on us. If Syria succeeds, we all benefit.
Should HTS's transition falter, the group could revert to its militant roots, reigniting conflict and posing renewed threats to Jordan's security. Jordanian analyst Amr Asabeli, a non-resident fellow at the Washington-based Stimson Center, tells VOA that Jordan can reshape and support efforts for Damascus to be a good counterpart by working together on concerns like security, logistics, telecommunications, and electricity.
This might help Jordan to reshape a good relation based on a win-win situation where Jordan as well can definitely benefit from a new reality in Syria, especially on the level of political influence, political interest, and definitely being a part of rebuilding Syria.
Badur and El-Sabeli also warned that HTS's Islamist ideology could influence other similar movements, like Jordan's Muslim Brotherhood. Badur points to attempts by the Brotherhood to dominate Jordanian public sentiment over the Gaza conflict and its relative political gains in parliamentary elections last September. Al-Sabaili comments.
But HTS is not controlling all the Syrian geography. ISIS has growing capacities, desire to control certain areas closer to the Jordanian borders. What happened in Syria might trigger the appetite and desire for power of all the political Islam groups, Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS as well, who at the end think that maybe they deserve also to be recognized in certain areas if they prove to be on the map.
Badur writes that even if HTS successfully transitions to a governing regime, its Islamic orientation poses a unique challenge for Jordan. She points to critics of the group who say they fear that legitimizing HTS could embolden dormant extremist factions within Jordan, possibly exacerbating internal tensions. Ultimately, she notes that Jordan must navigate these overlapping domestic and regional challenges, as HTS's trajectory and its implications for Syria, Jordan, and the broader Middle East remains deeply uncertain. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
And to the west of Jordan, Israeli forces invaded Syria on the day the regime of Bashar al-Assad fell in December, and they remain in areas surrounding the Golan Heights. Villages, towns, and cities in southern Syria have been under the control of Israeli forces for more than a month, and local people now fear that Israeli troops have come to stay. Jan Boyshat reports from the city al-Bath in an area of Syria bordering the Golan Heights.
The children have stopped coming to play at this amusement park in al-Ba'af, the capital of Syria's Al-Qunaitre province, which borders the Golan Heights, a region of Syria seized by Israel more than a half a century ago. On the same December day Bashar al-Assad's regime fell, Israeli forces entered the city. Now, a Merkava tank sits just a few hundred meters from these empty swings. Israeli forces have taken control of the area designated as a buffer zone within Syrian territory, established under the 1974 armistice that ended the war between the two countries. Tanks, soldiers, military checkpoints, and outposts now occupy this zone, which is officially under UN control.
Nothing is stopping the Israelis from entering the city. They are violating the 1974 agreements, and their tanks have even reached the municipality building.
Sleiman explains that most of the villages around al-Ba'af were occupied by Israeli forces on December 8th. They began searching homes and public buildings for weapons. Israel says the occupation is temporary, but residents fear it may not be. Many of those living in this area were originally displaced from the Golan Heights, occupied by Israel during the Six-Day War in 1967 and since annexed. Among them is Siwan, a retired teacher who declined to give her full name.
I don't believe this is about weapons. There is a broader, long-term goal. They want to occupy more land. The Golan is rich in water resources and fertile soil, and they are greedy to have it.
Those who have tried to protest the occupation say Israeli forces have responded with violence. At least one person has been shot, and many claim they've been beaten or arrested. VOA reached out to Israel Defense Forces officials for comment on the accusations, but did not receive an immediate response. The Israeli government says it plans to maintain what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls a temporary defense position, and says it will keep its forces in Syria until a new permanent Syrian government is established. Syria's transitional government wants Israeli forces out. Their calls have been echoed by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who has also called for Israel to withdraw. Ian Buesha, VOA News, al-Ba'af, Syria.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.